Let us carry forward the plans and programs of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, not because of our sorrow or sympathy, but because they are right. The tax bill has been thoroughly discussed for a year. Now we need action. And I therefore urge the Congress to take final action on this bill by the 1st of February, if at all possible.
Early in 1964, in his first State of the Union message, Lyndon Johnson asked Congress to complete action on the legislative programs left unfinished at the time of President Kennedy's tragic death by assassination in November 1963. Among these was the tax bill. It had been approved by the House of Representatives and was then before the United States Senate. In the Senate, as in the House of Representatives, any important legislation will be carefully considered for some time. There will be compromise and rewriting at several stages along the way before the bill is accepted or rejected by a majority of the members. One of the most prominent members of the Senate is Russell Long of Louisiana, a Democratic leader and, since 1965, chairman of the powerful Senate Committee on Finance. We ask Senator Long to tell us how the Senate of the United States goes about its legislative work. He began by outlining the first steps in the consideration of a bill, and as he spoke, he pointed up some of the differences between the Senate and the House of Representatives.
A typical bill in the Senate would be one introduced by a senator. He would introduce it. It would be referred to a Senate committee. If the members of the committee thought the bill was worthy of consideration, they would schedule hearings. They would bring witnesses before them who would testify to the merits of the bill and testify to the demerits of the bill. After the bill had been discussed, they would hold an executive session and discuss the amendments. They would vote on them, and they would report their bill. When you bring the bill before the Senate, any one of 100 senators has a right to offer any number of amendments and debate and try to get each one agreed to. In the United States Senate, there is no such thing as a closed rule. That type of freedom is not practical in the House of Representatives because they have so many members over there. Perhaps we are less efficient in that respect, but we're more democratic. Our rules permit much more flexibility and much more freedom of action on the part of each member. Our committees are smaller because our House is much smaller than the House of Representatives, and that permits us more latitude than the House. We don't have to limit senators in questioning witnesses nearly as much as a House would have to do, so that everyone gets his chance to ask about those things that he finds most important.
Generally, it is of no fundamental importance which House of Congress originates a bill or which House takes action on it first. Very often, both houses will consider legislation on the same subject at the same time, and each will pass a bill of its own. The two bills may be substantially different. Indeed, they quite often are. For it is basic to our legislative system that the two chambers operate independently of one another. Even where one house has completed action on legislation, members of the other house will usually insist upon a full review. They will study the basic problem, will make up their own minds as to what legislation is needed, if any. This was the case when the Revenue Act was placed before the Senate. Listen to the comments made by a number of senators at the time. Some oppose the bill, some favor it, some will try to change it. It is clear that Senate consideration, too, will be thorough. Here is Senator Harry Byrd of Virginia.
The tax bill will bring about a great deficit. It will have to be added to the public debt. I think that's a very unsound practice, and I'm opposing it.
Senator Edmund Muskie of Maine.
The prospects for approval of the bill by the Congress, from my vantage point at the moment, are very speculative. I haven't made up my own mind on it.
Senator Albert Gore of Tennessee.
It's a bad bill. I'd like to kill it. I don't think it is possible to do that. I would sure like to see this happen. In the meanwhile, I will try to amend the bill in several ways to make a better bill out of a bad bill.
Senator Paul Douglas of Illinois.
I think a tax cut is probably desirable. Well, I would say that on the whole, the good in it outweighs the bad.
Senator William Proxmire of Wisconsin.
I intend to introduce some amendments, and I'll argue as forcefully as I can for them. But I'm not going to obstruct it, and I know of no other senator who will, I'm sure.
Senate discussion of the tax bill began under special circumstances that apply to legislation dealing with taxation and with appropriation of money. In such cases, members of the Senate do not draft their own bill as they would on most subjects. Instead, they accept for consideration the bill that has been approved by the House of Representatives. But this procedure by no means implies that the Senate will forego a complete reconsideration of the bill, or that there will not be significant changes in the Senate version. For the Senate has the prerogative of amendment, as Senator Long noted when he recalled the early stages of Senate action on the Revenue Act of 1964.
All revenue bills have to originate in the House. The Constitution requires that. But the Constitution also says that the Senate may amend those bills. Sometimes we've placed as many as 500 amendments on a big bill. When the House sent us the Revenue Act of 1964, the Finance Committee conducted hearings for quite a while on it. It was more than a month, about 6 weeks. That committee handles all revenue bills. The statement of a witness, such as the Secretary of the Treasury, may be almost identical when he appears before the second committee, such as the Finance Committee, after he has previously appeared before the House Committee on Ways and Means. The questions will not necessarily be the same, because you have different men who are thinking about different matters who are fully appraised of what the testimony was and what the general line of questioning was in the House of Representatives. But they might want to ask about something that wasn't brought out at all in the House of Representatives. Then we had about a month in executive session when, behind closed doors, we would consider all the various provisions of the bill, and there were hundreds of them. Then we would consider amendments that, as I recall, we had around 300 Senate amendments on the bill. Having considered and voted on all these amendments, we then voted to report the bill and drafted a committee report, which was more than 100 pages long, explaining what the committee had decided. A committee hardly ever reports a bill unfavorably in the Senate, and I believe that would be the case in the House. If they do not agree with the bill, they usually table the bill, simply move to set it aside and give it no further consideration. And that's usually the end of the bill. In some cases, a committee will simply decline to consider the bill at all. Committees both in the Senate and the House have sometimes kept a bill in the committee and not reported the bill at all, even though it was a bill at the very top of the President's recommendations. It is usually the chairman's decision. The committee chairman does have more power and more influence than any individual senator on the committee ordinarily. Now, if a committee chairman tends to ignore the views of a majority of the committee to the extent that the majority decide it's time to take charge themselves, they sometimes do simply run over the chairman, move to bring a bill up, consider it, and insist on reporting it. The president can urge that the committee consider the measure. He's privileged to talk to individual senators and individual congressmen. He doesn't do nearly as much of that as the press would make you believe. He respects our right to differ with him. And my feeling is that he discusses these matters with us enough that we know what he thinks about them, and if we have our own responsibility to do what we think is best in the national interest. Because while it's true that we're all one big government, we are three separate branches of the government, and we should coordinate, but we should not be controlled by the other. We work parallel to, and we work with, a president. We don't work for him.
Once a Senate committee has reported a bill, it will go to the floor of the Senate for debate and voting. The procedures at this point differ considerably from those in the House of Representatives. The Senate Rules Committee has no jurisdiction over the scheduling of bills, and it is not empowered to set a time limit on debate or to judge whether a bill can be amended. In the Senate, debate is unlimited, and virtually all bills are open to amendment. Senator Long has told us how a bill is brought to the Senate floor and what may happen to it once there.
The party that has a majority has what is known as a policy committee. That policy committee will meet and decide the order in which various bills are to be called up for consideration. This is more or less a scheduling matter because the idea is to consider virtually every bill that is reported by a committee. Sometimes a policy committee will in the main be against the bill, but they still feel an obligation to schedule it for consideration when they can get around to it. And the majority leader usually makes a motion that this particular bill should be considered at this time, and usually that motion is decided without debate. The bill has a floor manager to manage it and lead the debate in favor of the bill after the bill has been called up. The floor manager explains the bill, then you're in position to consider the various amendments that individual senators will offer on the floor. There's no particular order in which those amendments are called up. It's more or less left to each senator to offer his amendment to whenever he thinks appropriate. It's somewhat difficult for a floor manager under that set of circumstances to know what amendment he should be prepared on next. In the case of the bill that we're discussing, we had hundreds of proposed floor amendments there, and it would have been a comfort to have known which one would be called up next in order to be better prepared for it. Now, I can recall years when senators on the floor were not successful in getting any amendments agreed to some of these big revenue bills that would go through the Senate. That being the case, you can see that the bill was really drafted by the committee, and the Senate as a whole was merely giving its stamp of approval to what the committee had done. That is very often the case. For example, in the consideration of the big bill that I mentioned, that was the biggest revenue bill ever to pass the Congress, we agreed to more than 100 amendments in the Senate Committee on Finance. We agreed to accept a few amendments that we thought were relatively non-controversial on the floor, but there was only one amendment offered that the committee did not agree with, which was voted onto the bill on the floor of the Senate. But I have many times seen said amend bills to the extent that the committee would hardly recognize it. And that is part of the democratic process that exists in the Senate.
This general freedom of debate on the Senate floor has produced the controversial tactic known as the filibuster, in which a group of senators, or even a single senator, will speak at great length for the express purpose of preventing a vote on the bill under consideration. We asked Senator Long for his opinion of this frequently criticized procedure.
If a person thinks that he is very much right about a matter, and he believes that he can persuade other people that he is right, then I believe that he's well justified in debating the matter to prevent it from coming to a vote, at least as long as he believes he has some prospect of gaining votes. If those senators feel strongly enough about it to feel that the matter is contrary to the national interest, so much so that they should talk all year long if need be to prevent it from coming to a vote, they have that privilege. I respect it. I have on occasion joined in such debates myself. Usually the nation decides issues of that sort. If they don't pass in one Congress and fail to pass in another, then it's usually because the measure simply does not have merit.
Legislation before the Senate usually reaches final form on the floor. Amendments are accepted, and the revised bill, if it passes, represents an act of the Senate. At this point, it becomes necessary to compare the Senate bill with the bill passed by the House of Representatives on the same subject. If the two differ, and very often they do, a specially appointed committee must meet and settle the differences. It is known as a conference committee, and its members are known as conferees. They meet in closed session, make their decisions, and submit a report which must, in some final form, pass both the houses if the bill is to become an act of Congress. Only then is the bill placed before the President of the United States for his signature. These steps, the last in the legislative sequence, were recalled by Senator Long as he spoke of the final passage of the revenue bill.
Then we brought the bill to the Senate. We debated it, and the debate lasted for about 1 week. Considering the size of the bill and the amount involved, that is a short period of time to debate a revenue bill of that much consequence. Now, when the bill had been passed in the Senate, we then nominated conferees to meet with the House of Representatives. The House sent five men to meet with five men from the Senate. We then proceeded to go over each amendment that the Senate had made to the House bill and arrive at an agreement on each one of them. And only after we were able to agree that we would either accept or reject or modify each of these amendments were we in position to sign a conference report recommending that certain amendments be agreed to and certain amendments be rejected, and that certain amendments be agreed to in part. In that case, the House conferees, headed by Chairman Wilbur Mills, took their conference report back to the House of Representatives and debated that again and voted on it. When it was agreed to there, then we took it up in the United States Senate, debated the conference report, and voted to accept the bill as it had been agreed to by the conferees. Then it was ready to go to the President for his signature. And, of course, the President signed it. He gave us some notice in advance and invited those who had played a prominent part in passing this bill to come down to the White House. And he had something of a ceremony. He used a number of pens to sign it and gave a pen to those senators and representatives who had played a major part in passing that bill.
Today I have signed into law an $11.5 billion reduction in federal income taxes, the largest in the history of the United States. This legislation was inspired and proposed by our late beloved President John F. Kennedy, and passed this week with the support of both Republicans and Democrats in the Congress. I especially want to congratulate tonight Congressman Wilbur Mills from this great state of Arkansas for his leadership in the House Ways and Means Committee and piloting the bill through the House of Representatives. I want to especially congratulate Senator Russell Long of Louisiana for his able leadership in the Senate. To the members of the Congress present here tonight, I want to say on behalf of the American people, thank you.
We have followed one particular bill through the Congress, have seen both the United States Senate and the House of Representatives act as they typically do in shaping an item of legislation. Our national legislative process is fully understood only in the context of these two houses, equal under the Constitution, but distinct from one another. Their procedures differ, and the general interests and concerns of a member of the one house may not be precisely those of a member of the other house. We spoke about this overall legislative process with Kenneth B. Keating, Associate Judge of the Court of Appeals of the State of New York. Judge Keating was a Republican member of the House of Representatives for 12 years, and subsequently served 6 years as United States Senator from New York. We asked Judge Keating to comment from the depth of his experience on the two houses and on their members.
If you're a representative, you're primarily interested in your particular congressional district and their interests and demands. If you're a senator, you are influenced by a much larger electorate, and you're trying to represent all of the people in that state. I've been in both places so that I have something of the viewpoint of both of them. The senator, and I speak of one from a populous state, is very, very much busier than a member of the House of Representatives. You're representing 17, 18 million people as against 300,000 to 500,000 in a congressional district. Therefore, the pressures of all kinds are very much greater in the Senate, and therefore you have somewhat less time for doing the things that you feel you should do as a representative of the people. That's one side of it. A senator has a little more relaxed attitude so far as re-election is concerned. Normally doesn't get back to his state as much as a representative, except the last 2 years of his term. He has a longer term, of course. And a representative has to keep in close touch with his constituents, because just about as soon as he's elected, he has to start running again. It's desirable to have a representative, in the true sense of the word, who is close to the people, and to have each state represented by roughly the number which their population would justify, then in the entire body, New York, for instance, will reflect a greater weight in the House of Representatives than some small state. On the other hand, our founding fathers felt the state influence was great, that there should be an offsetting principle involved, and that in the other body, each state should be on an equal footing and should each have two representatives.
The principles of representation under the Constitution, by state in the Senate, by local district in the House, point up the basic fact that every member of Congress, although he sits as a part of our national government, represents a particular geographical area of our country. We ask Judge Keating to comment on this dual obligation of a member of Congress.
When you swear to defend and support the Constitution, you are, in effect, first of all, a national legislator, and that your first obligation is to your country. One should feel that if the interests of his state or his district clearly clash with the interests of the United States as such, that his first obligation is to his country, and that he owes it to vote according to the dictates of his conscience as to what is best for the nation, even though he represents a particular segment of the country. But it rarely occurs. I can only think of two or three instances in my own background where I felt I was clearly casting a vote against the wishes of my constituents because I thought it was best for the country.
In closing, we ask Judge Keating to comment on the composition of Congress as a whole, how the members of Congress today fulfill their basic representative function.
Well, I think they reflect the feeling of a very wide segment of the people, cross-section of the general public, very well. There are industrial and labor leaders, lawyers of all kinds of backgrounds. There are doctors and all kinds of professional people, farmers. And I would say they are drawn from all manner of occupations and professions, and they're an interesting group. In the House and even in the Senate, you'll find all kinds of personalities, all kinds of backgrounds, and they're mostly sincere, hardworking men and women who really do the very best they can to represent the people that sent them to Washington. And I think that they, by and large, do a remarkable job in that respect.
Two houses, both representative in their separate ways, equal under the Constitution, but distinct. This is the Congress of the United States. How it works, how Congress passes a law.